Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place in the planet. The environmental movement needs art, and that's where Signal Fire comes in. Signal Fire is an environmental justice and arts nonprofit based in Portland that connects artists and activists with our remaining wild places. Today we talk with Signal Fire's co-director and operations coordinator, Eden Redman, about how Signal Fire connects artists with the environment and activists working to protect it. Eden, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, when I think of arts and activism, sometimes I think there's like a real dichotomy because we have a cliche of artists as having like they're very self-absorbed, kind of living in their own world, in their little garret or whatever, and not connected to the social world. And then we think about activist art as being kind of like Phil Oakes or Pete Seeger music, or kind of very didactic, blatant kinds of graphic arts. But my experience with what I've seen of Signal Fire artists and productions is quite different. So how does Signal Fire kind of break through these cliches and distinctions between arts and activism and bring them together?
Thanks for the question. Yeah, I think it really gets to the core of a belief that's, it gets to the core belief that's central to our organization being that the romantic, isolated notion of artists, just like the kind of isolated or potentially extremist views of activists, both of those things just seem to be false to us. We see those communities coming much more together. In our experience, artists tend to be very deeply integrated in their communities. They are educators often, they are parents often, they are often community organizers, and many of our artists consider their activist and artist identities as intertwined rather than distinct. And so to us, we see artists, regardless of the kind of product that they're making, regardless of the medium that they are engaged in, as deeply involved in their communities, and we see them as creative researchers and problem solvers, which to us makes them a really ideal pair for activists, who we see to be incredibly driven, have a great sense of value and measurement on a global scale. And so when we can pair that organization with that innovation, we see incredible things happen.
Well, interestingly, today I got an email from 350 PDX just before I came, and it was a call for artists. Mm. And they had great photos from the Juliana versus United States rally last week, or 2 weeks ago, I guess now, of the president's heads that they showed as it was part of a skit about how each president has basically supported policies that have promulgated climate chaos. And then they had showed their wonderful sunflower umbrellas and basically calling out to their email list, you can become part of this. And I do think it's one of the things that I really appreciate about the 350 movement is how much they incorporate art into the movement. But I think you take it another step. So let's talk about what distinguishes the kinds of art and activism interaction that you do at Signal Fire with kind of the traditional posters and banners and songs and things that we see at rallies.
Mm-hmm. I really adore that kind of creative making, the posters and songs and banners that we do see at rallies. But you're right, Signal Fire, it is a different kind of engagement. And primarily that engagement is that we trust the artists that come on our residencies, that they know the best way to produce art that will resonate back at home with their own communities. They will produce something that is all unique of their own. It will organically come back with them to their communities, and the import, the impression that they get of being in natural spaces will then proliferate through their community, through their art making. So sometimes it's very subtle. Sometimes it's a theme within a curriculum that an art teacher might be organizing at their school that semester. Sometimes and that theme being decolonizing Western narratives of land engagement, right? Or it might be something like a curator might come on a trip of ours and design an exhibition interrogating land narratives within the state of Oregon for an exhibition back at their gallery the next year. So we really trust that artists know their tools best, they know their communities best, and really when they come on our trips, we just want them to get connected with the land. We want them to be invested in the places that we take them and trust that the impact of that trip will naturally make its way back into their work and into their communities.
Well, a number of years ago, there was this attempt to integrate arts and the environment with some, I don't remember who was funding this program, but there were a bunch of artists up in Forest Park doing weird things, basically, and having these strange little installations, and then there'd be musicians playing out of the corners. And my sense is somebody, in those days, I lived on the east, west side, and I was going to Forest Park every day, and I just wanted them to get out of there, because it was really disrupting my wildland experience. And my sense when I saw that, what made it feel wrong to me was I feel like these artists don't know how to be in the woods. Mm. So what's the difference between that kind of interaction between artists and wild spaces and what you do? I mean, how do you, first of all, get artists to appreciate what it means to be in wildlands?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, sadly, arts makers have a really ugly history of being disruptive in the landscape. I mean, look at the really, look at the massive land art sculptures that have been made all across the United States and elsewhere. That is not a model that we encourage. We encourage a leave no trace method of camping and hiking, and we encourage that mentally as much as psychically, we think, really wanting people to be in the space as an observer, as a researcher, as somebody who can soak up the experience without directly impacting the land there. And for a lot of our artists coming on our trips, many of them are first-time campers, and many of them are first-time backpackers. So it's a really rich opportunity to encourage folks to have that more respectful engagement with the land. And we consider that respectful approach from a couple of different directions, including when we take people on trips, we want to teach them about the history of that region, and not just the settler colonial history, but the history of the indigenous communities there. And ideally, and most often, the way that we can do that is by partnering and becoming friends with the indigenous communities there, inviting folks to come speak to our groups. So that is a way that we can encourage artists to be respectful in the land physically, just with a leave no trace model. If people want to engage with the natural environment, they are, if they want to move stone, if they want to move sticks, if they want to make music even, everything needs to be put back into its place after it's been engaged with. And then we also have a variety of solitary time and group time on the trip. So the kind of maybe performative element that you're referring to of the musicians up in the park, we may have group performances or group sharing throughout the trip, but there's a fair amount of like solitary time to consider as well. So I think it's a much more agreed upon and private experience that doesn't disrupt the space for others.
Well, I'm thinking as the older I get, the more I've been learning to look and listen. Mm. And not impose my presence, and particularly in terms of being an artist. And I find that the time that I spend in the woods is like being amazed and absorbing the beauty and the amazement of nature, mm-hmm. and what nature can put together, which I don't think the greatest artist in the world could not replicate the intense depth of natural beauty. But I have this remembering back when I was in my 20s, and I was on a really nice lonely beach in Oregon, and I was playing my recorder, and some friends were sitting with me, and they told me that these sea lions came out of the water and came up to the shore and listened, and then they went back into the ocean.
Oh, wow. That's lovely.
So that was my favorite audience. I never saw them with my eyes shut while I was playing. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking back about how there are ways that you can perform in nature, maybe perform for nature sometimes, but it takes a certain amount of being inside and allowing nature to take over for you and sort of embrace you. How do you get an artist who is pretty much of a city dweller and who's never backpacked before and maybe never really been in the woods, maybe never even been to Forest Park, how do you get them to slow down enough to absorb and listen to what's and watch what's around them?
I have to give credit to our guide collective. The folks who lead the trips have this incredible capacity to, they have to juggle so many pieces. They have to keep folks physically safe on trips. They have to cultivate a sense of community vulnerability and trust among 8 to 12 strangers in the backcountry so that we know if we encounter a dangerous example or a dangerous circumstance, how do we move through it as a group? And they also have to share and teach these ideas of observing, listening, being aware of your surroundings. So it's really the work of our co-director, Ryan Pierce, who oversees and collaborates with the Guide Collective. That whole team does an incredible amount of work to think through to think of the very question that you're asking is, how do we get folks to slow down, to observe, to be present in space? And for folks coming from an urban environment, it's often a pretty stressful transition into the backcountry. It's very quiet for starters. The main note that we get back from alumni residents is they reflect on how quiet it is when they're on their trip and then how noisy their hometown feels when they get back.
Well, the other thing that I think about for myself sometimes when I'm in the woods, when I haven't been there for a while, and for people that I sometimes hike with, that how noisy the inside of our heads is when we are out in the woods. And that's a really important thing, is like, how do you train people to quiet down their minds so that they actually can hear what's around them?
That's a great question. I think as much as our guides and hopefully the team dynamic can facilitate a sense of inner calm, some of that we look for in advance when artists are applying to the residency. We look for a type of thoughtfulness and reflection that comes through in whatever materials they submitted, whether it's photographs of their artwork, whether it's their written statement. Some folks choose to submit like a letter of recommendation. We want to see that sense of reflection as being, we want to see that artist is receptive already to that type of thoughtfulness, and then ideally that combination of our guides facilitating the experience, and then a safe and engaging group dynamic out in the backcountry can make that possible.
Now, do you bring activists along with the artists when you do these outings?
Oh yeah, and that's the main point of the trips, is to have both groups come together and mingle.
So how do you get activists connected with artists, or how do you get artists connected with activist groups?
In advance to trips or on trips themselves? Or?
Well, both. And just, yeah, in advance, first of all.
Yeah. We do a lot of footwork networking. We just try to meet as many folks as possible that are in different activist organizations, and also just within our own communities. We try to expand the definition of activist and artist as well, to include educators and to include organizers maybe of a less Western expectation of what community organizing looks like. So primarily footwork, building relationships, and showing up for other people, making sure that we are bringing artists, and we, the organization, are showing up to rallies and meetings and protests and organization to make sure that we are being accountable in building that authentic relationship with activists.
So it sounds like the main activism that you're looking at is environmental activism. Is that
yes.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
So why environmental activism? I mean, because it seems from looking at your website that it's more than just activism. It's really trying to connect artists with a real sense of wonder for nature.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the episodes of Locus Focus that I've listened to recently, you do such a good job of inviting on guests that really understand that environmental work is the basis and the precedent for so much other social justice work as well. There's this intersection that the health and the wellness and the relationship that people have with the environment, how we value those things, shape, impact, and reflect the kind of injustices and values that we hold socially more broadly. And so for us, we do maintain a sense of just care and awe and enjoyment of being out in the backcountry and being out on the land, but we also see it as being a critical basis to doing additional social justice work, including in urban spaces.
So how do you do that?
We do it by I'm sorry. Can you do which? Do what?
Well, I'm just wondering how you bring these people back to, I mean, from how you take whatever you've learned from nature and bring it back to the city and to the ongoing and never-ending political struggles that we're involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's one of the main reasons that we chose to do a residency model. The idea is to take people out into the backcountry. We primarily go to public lands with the hope that they will be accessible to residents in the future who want to revisit their time. But the idea of like dedicating time out in nature, taking 1 week, 2 weeks, some of our residencies are 4 weeks, closer to 5 weeks. The idea of taking that time and committing it to a period of reflection, we believe, and we have seen it time and again, that the artists and activists who take the time to be there, who come on the trip, who really are vulnerable to the experience, will then take their own toolkits back into urban spaces, into rural communities, into schools, and apply the knowledge that they've experienced. And again, that's like trusting the artist and trusting the activists that they know their community best. We consider it to be like a deep seed, slow release kind of impact.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eden Redman, who co-directs and is the operation coordinator for Signal Fire, which is it's a nonprofit arts organization that is the intersection between the arts and activism. And we're talking about how Signal Fire connects artists with the environment and activists working to protect it. Well, let's step back a little bit and talk about how Signal Fire even got started. Because I'm trying to think of any other organization I've ever known that's quite like it, and I haven't come up with any. So how did this get birthed?
Sure, yeah. Well, I'm really proud to say that we just celebrated our 10-year anniversary. So 10 years ago, Ryan Pierce and Amy Harwood came together as an artist and an activist, and they said, we have really, really incredible friends, dynamic, caring, thoughtful friends who care deeply about their communities, who care deeply about the environment, and who we have a lot of fun with when we go backpacking. What if we turned it into a more organized coalition? And so the impulse was always to bring artists and activists together first and to bring them to the backcountry together. And so 10 years ago, that started as backpacking trips, as day hikes, as solo overnight campers. I believe it's an old Ford Bronco that was in our possession at one point that we would drive folks around in. And since then, it really has evolved to be a broader, we're a nonprofit now, so it's evolved to be a broader set of programming where we have a tinderbox program where we install an artist in an environmental organization for a period of time, and then they can produce artwork based on the exchange that happens between the organization and the artist. We have residencies where we take folks from the backcountry. We do in-town programming. And so although it started as a camping and hiking group, as we grew our community and were receptive to the feedback and the ideas of our community, it's become this much more, this very, very dynamic and exciting, multifaceted unit. And we're looking ahead at exciting growth as well.
Well, I'm thinking there's other groups that bring people into the woods. Bark has these hikes. Mm-hmm. Oregon Wild has hikes. Actually, Friends of the Gorge has hikes, mm-hmm. though I don't think they're overnight hikes. What distinguishes the hikes that you do and the backpacking trips that you do from some of these that are more traditional environmental activist organizations?
Sure. And we're big fans of those organizations. We're dear friends with Bark. Our founder, Amy Harwood, is on the board of Bark now and works with them. Our board president, Courtney Ray, also works with Bark. So we're big fans of them. But I think the key difference is who's in the room and what perspective is the hike being led from. I think when an artist leads a hike, they have different priorities moving through the space than maybe when a BARC member is leading a hike. And so there might be a sense of asking folks to observe in a slightly different way than maybe a forest protector may ask. We often include readings with our hikes from regional indigenous writers, regional environmental scientists, regional artists, to really physically plant a person on a hike and connect it with narratives and readings across time from people who have also appreciated that space.
So what is it like when you go on that hike? I'm sort of imagining the difference between, I mean, I've gone on hikes with all kinds of people. And personally, I like going on hikes with botanists and geologists because I learn a lot about the landscape. But what's the difference between going on a hike with a forest protector who's looking at pointing out, well, this is possible clear cut and this is, mm-hmm. there's a marble mule nest right there and things like that, to going on a hike with artists, and what are they seeing?
Sure. A couple of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of going out to Le Grand to do some programming with students at Eastern Oregon University, and my colleague Kaila Farrell-Smith, who you had on in February to speak about the Jordan Cove Project from the perspective of Klamath tribal members. Kaila and I headed out to Le Grand to meet up with some dear friends of ours out at Eastern Oregon University, and we took some students and some faculty and some community members on a hike, and Kaila shared this writing about the removal of the Nez Perce people from that space. And so going with art students on a hike are students who traditionally are very sedentary, who are very studio-based, who are making work in a confined area, to just get them to move their bodies and change their vision viewpoint. There is a really phenomenal set of studies in the arts community about what happens to your brain when you change your scope of field from a laptop, from a canvas, from a small space out into a large, long view horizon line. So to take these artists out on the hike, to listen to this kind of sense of wonder and engagement and struggle and appreciation, the observations are often very sweet and pretty comical. So we're moving through this space with these art students who are appreciating the hike. And then Kaila shared with us this writing about the removal of the Nez Perce. And so thinking about that confluence of observing and appreciating a space, getting to have your own individual authentic connection to that space, even through just like a 35-minute hike, and then to speak about what it means to be removed from that space. And of course, these students are only getting their independent contemporary slice of what that land means to them. So to even try to imagine what it means to an entire nation of peoples who's being forcibly removed creates a small window of empathy, we hope. And to physically be there with artists who are very historically minded, who are very research oriented and observant, and to share this history of the removal of native peoples, it really affects people. And we got to this hilltop and we were looking out at the Wallawas and seeing this great valley and thinking about the kind of physical and mental trauma that is inflicted upon the folks moving through, I think we were just with an incredibly receptive group of folks who then can really think on it and ruminate. And I look forward to seeing how that shapes their work in the future.
Did they come out with easels or did they just come out with their eyes?
They came out with their eyes. Some folks did have notebooks and sketchbooks. Yeah, so okay, we totally welcome folks bringing cameras or easels or anything they want to make imagery with.
Because it's one of those things about being an artist that you get out. I remember actually one time I was hiking to the first time I went to Bird Creek Meadow, and I went with a couple people who actually started the Columbia Gorge Audubon Society. And one of them was an artist, and we got up to the meadows, and it was actually the most beautiful time I've ever seen it. And every time since then, it was disappointing after this particular one. And of course, I'd forgotten my camera, and she didn't have her paints with her, and we were just sitting there having to enjoy it.
Yeah.
and not being able to recreate it. And it was an interesting experience, but I feel like that somehow it burned into my memory in a way that it wouldn't have if I just taken a lot of photographs, which is what I've done every other time I've gone up there.
Absolutely, yeah.
So how do you select the artists, and how much of this is self-selection, people finding out about you, and how much of it is you doing outreach and looking for the right artists to join the program?
So depending on what trip folks want to apply for, we have a couple of different selection processes. Our trips are open to the public, and our juried trips, we invite three artists who are maybe friends of our community, who are maybe adjacent to our community. We invite three artists or activists to review a set of materials that folks submit when they apply. And our application process is free. You don't have to submit any money to apply at all. We also try to make our applications as I think artist applications, especially, and residency applications, can be so bureaucratic and they can feel very stuffy, and you have to have these expectations of there's like a professionalism that's very daunting and is a barrier to many people. So we said no thanks to that. And instead, we just opted for an example of your work, whatever that means to you, and a written statement of why this trip would be important to you. And so we invite jurors to review this work, and we look for a few things. We look for kind of like the receptiveness and the maturity of the artist to see if they are a thinker who would really soak in a trip like this. We look for, and then we do try to build out a group dynamic that will be collaborative. So we need to think about people's physical safety first and foremost out in the backcountry. So we need, you know, if we had an entire group of one personality, it might not work. So we need to balance out the group dynamic a bit.
Wait, what do you mean by that? One personality?
Well, I mean, if we have a trip of 10 people and everybody has the I'm the leader, I take charge personality, then I don't think that trip will be very fun for anybody to go on.
And if you have a whole bunch of followers, it might not be much fun either.
Absolutely.
If everybody's looking for a leader.
Right, yeah. And so we really think through variety in our trips. We want as much diversity on our trips as possible, and I mean that as broadly as possible, including socioeconomic background, including racial and ethnic background, including region of the United States. We invite and have applications from folks all over the country. We have international applicants. We look for a variety in media making. So we don't, unless it's a media-specific trip, which we have done. We've done video-making trips. We've done writing trips. But we want a variety in the type of work folks are doing. If we have multiple activists applying into a trip, are they working on a variety of campaigns, for instance? If we have multiple filmmakers applying for a trip, is there a variety in medium or subject within their filmmaking?
Do you have audio people or just video people?
Oh, we have all people. Yeah, we have audio folks. We have musicians. We have musicians who bring instruments. We have musicians who make instruments out of the refuse and garbage that they find out in space. Marilyn McNeil being that artist who made instruments out of the garbage and the refuse that was found in the space. Yeah, we really get makers of all sorts.
And so where do these trips go?
Primarily in the Pacific Northwest and the Pacific Southwest. We have 5 bioregions that we focus on, and we also become invested in environmental campaigns in those bioregions.
So as an example, around here, where have you taken people?
We have taken people throughout Mount Hood National Forest. We've taken folks through the Wallawas. We go all over the Cascades. We're very concentrated in the Klamath Basin and Siskiyou's region as well.
So when a group is out in the woods, and these trips last, what, from a week to a month?
Mm-hmm.
So you actually do month-long backpacking trips?
Yeah, we do.
It sounds quite intense.
It is, yeah.
And so what is the program like when people are out there?
Yeah, when folks are out there for a shorter trip, there is a variety of structured time and independent diffuse time as well. So we usually have a central meeting location where we ask everybody to meet up in Portland or in Ashland or in Tucson, and then we all head out in the Signal Fire van, our Snow Baby 2. We all head out in the van and we get to the trailhead and we do our first hike in. And as we hike, everyone gets to know each other. And then throughout the course of the week, we have time where there might be structured hikes. There's maybe day hikes that are going out. We might have structured reading time. We make a great effort to compile readers to accompany each trip that feature writings and artwork from regional artists and artists and activists.
Readers meaning a printed reader, not a human being who's reading.
Correct, yeah. Meaning a printed reader. Yes, thank you. And so there might be structured reading time. There might be structured discussion time. There might be structured hiking time. But at the same time, we'll have wide open afternoons where folks can take a swim on their own, where folks can really be in their tent and be making work, where people can be hiking solo. We really do want this to be an opportunity for people to foster some resilience and independence. So as much as we really do want the group to come together, we highly encourage individual time too.
So you basically hike one day to a base camp, and that's where you're camped out for the week or the month, and you take off from there? Or are some of these hikes where you go have several base camps?
Well, more often than not, have several base camps, yeah. There is one model of trip that we do called Outpost, where we have big 12x12 canvas tents, and that is a more stationary opportunity that's much more like art making and poster making and work making focused, so it needs to be more stationary.
So how far out in the woods do you usually get to? Give me a place, as I'm a lover of Mount Hood. So give me an example of a hike you take on Mount Hood and where you'd be camping and where you'd be hiking.
Sure. Well, I hate to disappoint, Barbara. I'm sorry, but my background's really as an arts administrator. I've been on one Signal Fire trip myself. My knowledge of being in the backcountry and where our hikes go specifically is a little bit limited. But I did have the joy of joining a trip last August that was up in the Mount Hood the Mount St. Helens blast zone. And so going up there and seeing the hikes throughout the zone was really incredible. But I'm sorry, I don't have a better reference point for
you. That's okay. I can visualize that too. It's another wonderful place. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eden Redman, co-director and operations coordinator for Signal Fire. We're talking about how Signal Fire connects artists with the environment and activists working to protect it. Now, the Signifier project, what actually first awoken me to Signifier was a project called Notes from the Columbia Riverkeeper, I think, by Holcomb Weller, who is a very amazing and very original musician. And I was curious about how that got started and what kind of integration Holcomb experienced with Columbia Riverkeeper.
Again, I'm going to have to admit to the limit of my time at Signifier. I just celebrated 1 year with the organization.
So you just missed Holcomb's
tenure. I just missed it. But I know it lives famously in our archives and in our community. That project touched many, many people. Folks have been really excited about it. But I do know, I can speak to the structure of what Holcomb was doing. Holcomb was, I believe, our first member who did a Tinderbox project, which I mentioned a little bit earlier, where we invite an artist and we embed them within an activist organization for an amount of time. We give them a stipend for the time that they spend there, and then we just see what comes of it. And there's often a lot of crossover and just dialogue happening between the groups. Sometimes there is a distinct project that's made from that work. Sometimes it's a little more diffuse and comes about later. But the idea, again, is just that cross-pollination. Like, what happens when you get makers in a room with activists and see how they influence one another's work?
Well, I know what I do know about Holcomb's project from what he described in the performance itself, that he spent a lot of time with Columbia Riverkeeper. He both spent time talking to them, hanging out with them, going to actions, and also doing a lot of research himself. In fact, he was one of the few people who knew who owned U.S. Oil at the time when the Mosier oil train derailed in Mosier. It was on its way to Tacoma to U.S. Oil, but everybody just knew U.S. Oil. Holcomb did the Google research and found out the two hedge fund owners who actually owned it at the time. So I was very impressed with his research ability. I'm not sure how much of that he brought to the project and how much of it he was learning, because also when you're around Columbia Riverkeeper, you're around some incredible researchers as well.
Absolutely.
So it was just interesting to watch the integration and how much he really came to understand not just Columbia Riverkeeper as an organization, but the history where they came from and how they and what they're doing and why it works, and then putting together this very unusual piece of music, which was not your typical political activist folk music at all. So I don't know how much you know about any of that, or if there's anything more you can add to what I just said.
Well, it sounds like you got to hear it straight from Holcomb during the performance.
Oh, I also saw it four times, so I had it memorized.
If you felt comfortable sharing, we were speaking a little bit before coming on the air about the impact that you had seeing one performance four times and how it resonated differently each time that you saw it. And I think that's such an impact, like that sounds like so impactful and a really interesting observation. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Sure. Well, I had the opportunity to see it twice because they asked me to be the moderator for the panel afterwards, which is when I learned all about Holcomb's process, because he talked a lot more actually after the show than he did while he was performing it about how he went about doing what he did. And the first night, it was shown at this place. It's over by the Willamette River in far north Portland in St. John's. And I'm trying to, I can't remember what this performance space is, but I've been to several shows there. It's a very interesting performance space. And it's right across from the railroad tracks. And there was an oil train parked right on the tracks night of the performance. Well, it turned out it was carrying vegetable oil. But it looked like bark and oil. So that was sort of the subtext for that performance. And the first night, they were still kind of getting some of the text stuff together. So it was kind of loud. It was hard to hear the lyrics. And several people, including myself, gave Holcomb some feedback about that. The next night, it was perfect. And I heard every lyric, and I was really, really amazed. And then I saw it at a dinner event Tony Starlight's, which was a benefit for Columbia Riverkeeper. And that, there was like, it was sort of a kind of more of a social setup. It wasn't as clear of a performance. And it seemed to lack something. It didn't seem like it was right for that space because it was such a demanding piece. And the music is very driving and very overpowering in a lot of ways. And then the lyrics, you have to catch every single one of them. And then the last time I saw it was the hall in at Clark College, where so many of the hearings around the oil trains and the coal trains were being held. And it was a place of also for celebration. So Columbia Riverkeeper gave this great party after the Vancouver Energy DeSoro Savage oil train terminal was terminated. And Holcomb did his performance one last time. And his performance was really a lot about stopping that oil terminal. And the big climax of it was when the oil train derailed in Mosier. but he did this thing of like the history of, well, he pulled all these threads together about the history of this and the history of that, and then it all came together in Mosher, basically, with that explosion. And then it was also talking about how much oil train traffic would really increase in the gorge if this oil terminal were built, which would have been North America's largest oil train terminal. So at that one, I was sitting next to the mayor of Mosher, who I've become kind of friends with, and I could see it wasn't her cup of tea. The music was just a little bit too edgy for what she likes, and I just wondered how many other activists in this room really respond to this kind of music. I never got a sense of it, but it was the one time, because I was sitting next to somebody who wasn't totally knocked out by the music, that I thought, well, this is kind of a niche kind of piece. And I was amazed and kind of impressed that Columbia Riverkeeper embraced it, which shows that they have a nice edgy, but very edgy approach and an understanding of art. And maybe this will take art to a more direction, you know, out more into communities that have been afraid of that kind of more complicated, more maybe intellectual kind of art.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think what you're speaking to, that one type of performance won't resonate with everybody, also is part of the reason why we invite the wide variety of activists and artists that we do. Similarly, one type of activism, I mean, you might be the type of audience for an activist message that doesn't like someone knocking on your door, but you do appreciate a group hall or a town hall, right? So yeah. Thinking about audience and thinking about venue and thinking through... we need everybody on the ground. We need a big variety of activist approaches. We need a huge variety of artistic production to reach as big of a variety of audience as possible.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking in terms of the intersection of arts and activism. I've been to many performances and seen lots of art shows and gone to lots of concerts where there's a very strong political message coming mm-hmm. across, and a very strong political sensitivity and more environmental and social sensitivities and understandings about the intersection of all of our issues. And that's not new, though maybe it's getting stronger, I'm not sure. But there's still a place when you go to a concert or you go to a show or you go to a gallery and you see these shows and they affect you while you're in there. But then the question is, how does that effect come home with each viewer, each audience member?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that question has permeated through art history for always. I think the takeaway question is a big one. And I think... I mean, not to sound like a broken record, we trust our artists and activists. We trust that they have a tool set or a community or a classroom that they know how to connect with. And so ideally, they will produce work that will speak to enough people. Again, not everybody. Folks will walk into that gallery and feel like they didn't take anything away from it. Folks will leave a film screening and say, oh, it was too on the nose, and I'm, you know, don't want to hear any more about this issue. But it really is just a matter of trusting the artists to make the work that they think will speak best to their community.
Now, in your one-year tenure at Signal Fire, do you have any other examples of a residency program like the one that Holcomb did? That either they're in progress now or they've been completed, that have that same kind of dynamics that his had?
It's a great question. We are working on building out the next issue of Tinderbox, and we're hoping to centralize it in Southern Oregon. Stay tuned for that one. But
does that focus on Jordan Cove by any chance, or beyond that? Water issues and...
I'm sure it will. Yeah, we joined the Power Past Fracked Gas Coalition. We are in close works with the No LNG campaign and with Rogue Climate and with Rising Tide Southern Oregon. So we are deeply invested in that region, and we're really just looking for the right pairing of artist and organization to launch that.
Well, you mentioned Kayla before, mm-hmm. Who I know is now, she lived in Portland for a long time, and I guess was born in Eugene, but now she's back in Modoc, which is just south of Chiloquin, and she's on her traditional land, the Modoc, mm-hmm. Klamath tribe's land. And she's on your board, isn't she?
Is. So we have three directors, myself, Ryan Pierce, and Kayla Farrell-Smith. So Kayla is, she has been with Signal Fire for about 5 years now, and she's worn many hats in her co-director position. And most recently, carved out this position as the Rural and Tribal Outreach and Collaborator and Coordinator. So she is in Southern Oregon specifically to hold us accountable to the regions that we visit, to make sure that we are invested in the campaigns and in the communities who live most closely to and are most affected by the environmental threats in those regions. And that includes making sure that we show up for different actions, making sure that we are leveraging the resources that we have in urban spaces. The majority of our contingency, our community for Signal Fire, is urban. And so thinking through how do we build genuine relationships with Indigenous and rural communities? How do we build those relationships? Learn what solutions are being crafted by the people in rural and tribal communities? And then how do we leverage our friends in urban spaces to most appropriately support our friends in rural and tribal spaces? Because we're all invested in that, in those wild lands. How do we make sure that we are following suit of what the communities closest to those lands want?
So Tequila moved back down to Modoc because I got the impression for personal reasons she wanted to reconnect with where she was from. But I wonder if she was also on a mission from Signal Fire. Or did she create her own mission?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both, yeah. And that is something I really appreciate about this work, is that Signal Fire really wants guides, staff members, and board members. We want this organization to fit, support, challenge, and trellis our own life, professional, creative, activist movements. And so I think for Kaila, you'll have to ask her directly, but from how we spoke about it as a staff, she was really called to be home. And she made that choice for really, really vital, creative, and personal community reasons. And because our work at Signal Fire is also very community oriented, it worked for the direction that our programs were growing to carve out this new position for her.
Well, actually, and she welcomed me to her homeland for a day a couple months ago.
Oh, wonderful.
And it was a very wonderful day. I mean, I went down, I was doing a tour, basically, of the Pacific Connector Pipeline for the documentary that I'm working on about frack gas. And I didn't have anything really nailed down in Chiloquin with the Klamath Tribes people. And Kaila wound up being the one person who was responding to my emails. Mm-hmm. And then I actually interviewed her for the show. And actually, I thought I asked her all the wrong questions. I mean, it was not, we had an interesting back and forth afterwards, but I was into this thing of like asking her questions that just popped off my head and not appreciating that she was like, in a lot of ways, new to Klamath County. I mean, this issue had been going on and she'd been up here most of the time. So she was doing a lot of catching up at that time. Mm-hmm. But still, it was a wonderful connection with her. So I really appreciated how she wound up connecting me with everybody I needed to talk to. It was like, it was magic. Everything happened as it was meant to be. Mm-hmm. But I also had the opportunity to go to a powwow that day, and it was I'm going to forget the name of their fish, but it's kind of the sacred fish, which is an eel-related fish that comes back in the spring, and it's very much like the first salmon ceremony.
Is it the lamprey?
It's not a lamprey. Okay. It has a name that does not stay in my brain.
Sure.
But it's a beautiful ceremony, and I wasn't able to go to the morning ceremony, but I went to the powwow, and it was one of those gifts of just like being able to sit. In a way, it's like being in wildlands. You know, mm-hmm. you're just there, and I was just listening and watching and appreciating and recording and just being really so appreciative that I was able to be there and witness this. And I appreciate Kaila for opening this opportunity up. And so I see her as one of these connective threads. And so for me, in a lot of ways, she was another one of my introductions to Signal Fire. And I wonder if that's how you see yourself, like you are connective threads to get the right people in the right places.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the greatest asset that we offer to artists, activists, Indigenous folks, and other partners who come together is that we're just trying to braid out and connect as many networks as possible. We want to make a reflexive, reactive, nuanced, community-specific, huge network. And I think the story that you just described of you and Kaila absolutely embodies that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Eden Redman, who's co-director and operations coordinator for Signal Fire, and we're talking about how Signal Fire connects artists with the environment and activists working to protect it. I was thinking as we were talking earlier and the whole experience of sending artists into the woods and getting them to listen and watch as opposed to just create. And one of the things that I've been obsessing about for the last few months is birdsong. Mm-hmm. And that I live right near Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge, and I go down there every day. And I was really appreciating the days before Oaks Park opened, because then when you're down there, you hear the Oaks Park barker and the kids screaming and the rock and roll. But when Oaks Park is not open, you hear all the bird calls. And I realized that I was going down every day for a concert. And I'm watching my own process of learning to listen, and learning to listen in ways I've never been able to do before or been open to doing. And do you see that process happening with artists who go into the woods, that it opens their eyes in ways that they would never have opened if they were not being able to slow down and be there for a while?
That's a really beautiful question. Yeah, I remember in art school, one of the most difficult, but I think one of the most generative pieces of advice that I ever gave was to be receptive to what is the work telling you. And then later, when I transitioned into writing, more like, what is the research telling you? You can't go in with a preconceived idea. You can go in with a general question or framework, but you really have to let the research tell you. What do the documents show you? And I think that is such a challenge for makers that becomes so, 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 so concentrated when you're in the woods, when you're in the backcountry, when you're in the desert. You really cannot, there are so little distractions when you're out in that space. You are solely confronted with what it means to be, well, not even what it means, but just the experience of being in that place. And so I think it is quite a challenging, but also a really, really fruitful opportunity for artists to be forced to just receive. What are they experiencing?
And what are some of the results that you've seen from that reception when they return and they create their works of art?
So that's an interesting kind of breakdown in our what folks might expect to come from Signal Fire versus what actually comes from Signal Fire. And it's something that, especially for like grants and foundations, there's always this question of what's the deliverable afterward. And, you know, we really encourage trips without a preconceived expectation of what will the deliverable be. We just want people to go have their trip, and they might not make work about it for many years. That trip might need the time to ruminate and gestate within their mind before it comes back and influences their work. More often than not, the letters that we get back from folks include, oh my gosh, thanks so much for this trip. I'm now best friends with this person that I met on the trip. So there's a lot of that networking element and that community building element that's so vital for the grassroots kind of work that we want to be doing. We get trips back that talk about, or we get letters that talk about the adjustment back into their day-to-day life, and how what they observed and learned, how their eyes were opened, as you said, in the backcountry influenced their perspective when they're back in their day-to-day world. But really, I mean, we are very reluctant to see somebody's work and say, oh, that came from a Signal Fire trip. We really just want to introduce folks to the opportunity to be in the backcountry. We want to show them how to do it safely and respectfully, and really just let them take the tools to do the work on their own.
Okay, so we've been talking mostly about the artists for the last 50 minutes. So let's talk about the activists. What are they doing all this while the artists are busy being absorbing inspiration?
Well, I hope the activists are absorbing inspiration as well. I mean, it's no secret to you that activist burnout is a very, very real and deeply felt issue within movements. And so I hope that being in the backcountry can be a restorative chance for activists to reconnect with kind of the core of maybe the region or the type of work that they're protecting and working with. And I hope that the camaraderie that develops between guides and activists, between artists and activists, between activists and activists, can really fill their cup back up. And also the exchange that naturally occurs, the conversations that are happening, hopefully rekindle, reinforce, challenge, and expand ideas, goals, vision, movement, strategies that the activists came in with.
So how do people get involved in the program?
Absolutely. So our main website is signalfirearts.org. And while we are headquartered in Portland, Oregon, we do work all over the Pacific Northwest and Southwest. On our website, you can find a variety of kind of day programming, and you can also find opportunities to look through our archival work. You can look through and connect with artists who are on our website. You can donate directly on our website. You can see upcoming events and newsletters on our website, too.
And you have a journal. journal as well, right?
We do have a publication. Yeah, we're very excited to share that the Regional Arts and Culture Council just granted us significant funding to make sure that our 8th journal will get published this year.
And before that, you were doing it for free?
We do it for free. Yeah, we sell our journal. But it's an opportunity for artists and activists to publish their work in our journal, and then we distribute it widely, cheaply. No one is turned away for lack of funds. We're always happy to share the journal.
So do you pay your writers, or is it basically just an opportunity to get their work out?
I have not yet been involved in the administrative process, but I know that in this last grant that we applied for, there are stipends for the writers, yes.
And what's the name of the journal?
Leaf Litter is our journal.
Why I noticed that when I was going on your website. I was saying, why Leaf Litter? Except that Leaf Litter is like very, it's what nurtures the forest.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, I think that's exactly the reference.
So if people wanted to get involved, I mean, what do they need to do in order to take the next step? Besides going on, getting involved in the residency and getting involved in the trips.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if somebody wanted to do a residency, how would that work?
If someone wanted to do a residency, we open our annual applications in January or February of every year. So our 2019 roster is booked. However, our in-town programming and our day hikes and day programs are open and ongoing throughout the year. And you can find that calendar at signalfirearts.org. And if you are in the Pacific Northwest, you're welcome to email me directly. And I love getting coffee dates and finding collaborative opportunities and meeting up with folks all over. And my email is Eden, E-D-E-N, at signalfirearts.org.
So there's day hikes that people can go on. And are those, those things you just sign up for, you don't have to apply for?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's like BARC's day hikes kind of thing.
Awesome. Yep. Which you just sign up. We invite local artists and activists to select a reading or a podcast or a piece of media that resonates with the hike that they're going to take us on. We join up as a group, we go on the hike, and then we discuss that media that was shared in advance and see how did other people connect with that piece of media to that space.
So where do you see yourself developing in the future?
Oh, gosh. This is a very exciting question as we just finished our 10-year anniversary celebration. But I think we just want to continue to grow the network, but deep, more so than wide.
So spreading the roots.
Absolutely, spreading the roots. We are established with really remarkable and dynamic organizations, and we just want to make sure that we can really support the folks that we visit on trips throughout the year in a year-round capacity. We want to make sure that we are building deep, stable precedents to continue to spread this communication and this experience through the folks through the folks around us.
So if a group is interested in having an artist embed in their organization, as Holcomb did with Columbia Riverkeeper, how do they go about doing that?
I think you can email me directly and we'll get you paired off.
So Basically this is kind of a fluid thing that sort of depends on who's available and who's interested. And
absolutely. Yeah. And we consider that a strength because then we get to respond to the communities and regions who not only are excited to work with us, but who are in a position to grow partnerships and we really find that when folks are excited to find partnerships, it's the more generative space to work within.
So one last thing. I'm interested. You mentioned a little bit earlier about how most of the resources are in urban areas and a lot of the needs are in the rural and tribal areas. So how do you work to get more people in urban areas engaged in what's happening outside the city? Now, I've seen a big shift in Portland in the last year since I've been very much engaged with what's going on in Kalama with the methanol refinery and getting more engaged with Jordan Cove and being really appreciative of how many people from Portland came up for the hearing in Longview for the methanol refinery last December, how many people are showing up in Salem and actually in Portland too for Jordan Cove hearings, if not going down to Medford. And so there does seem to be more of that happening. I'm wondering how Signal Fire can really help to generate more response and more interest amongst urban dwellers in what's going on in these really crucial rural areas.
That's a great question. And I think there's a little bit of growing pains to it. We want to make sure that, I think the thing that Signal Fire can lend most is a platform and a megaphone. I think that given the network that we have, we can send out word quickly if we need bodies at a protest, if we need letters sent into the governor, if we need public comments to FERC, we can reach out to folks and get that immediate response. And I also think that we want to be careful about how we are asking folks to help. Again, we just really want to make sure that we are supporting communities who ask for support and who are leading the charge, who are formulating plans that are from the community that's most affected.
Yeah, I've had some interesting experiences in Kalama, I mean, and talking to people there about their response to this onslaught now of people from, particularly from Seattle. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think there's even more connection with Seattle people and people from Portland, that these city folks don't take over their movement. There's
right.
a little bit of that, and I understand that. I mean,
right.
if people in Portland worry about the Seattleites coming down, the Seattle kayakers coming down and taking over stuff, which sort of happened a few years ago. So that's another thing about understanding sensitivity. It seems like we really need to teach ourselves how to listen to people who may not seem as sophisticated as we are, who maybe don't have the years and years of activism experience that we have, but who are grounded in their communities and mm-hmm. have a passion to really fight and to protect their communities.
Well, I really respect what you said earlier about your conversation with Kaila, where you had questions that in hindsight felt less appropriate because she was a new person there. And I think in listening to that conversation, she was so quick to credit her predecessors. And I have to credit the organizations that we're working with in Southern Oregon, the No LNG campaign, Southern Oregon Rising Tide. And I'm just really impressed that these organizations have that community nuance, which is why they're the folks we want to partner with.
Well, it's really great to talk with you, Eden. Good to meet you and good to learn more about Signal Fire. So stay in touch.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking today with Eden Redman, who's co-director and operations coordinator for Signal Fire. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus, or go to iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we're going to rebroadcast the interview I did with Bill McKibben in May. And the following week, when I get back to town, we'll get the Puget Sound perspective on the proposed world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, with Washington Sierra Club organizer Cecile Gernes and Claudia Riedner with Redefined Tacoma. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Aaron Neville. Thanks for listening.
There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little shy and sad of eye, but very wise was he. And then one day, a magic day, he passed my way, and while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me.